Today on the 21st show, as the war between Israel and Iran threatens to intensify and potentially involve the United States, we'll talk about the latest and hear how Illinoisans are processing the news. We have a panel of experts, including political scientists Nicholas Grossman of the University of Illinois Urbana, Norma Claire Maruzzi of the University of Illinois Chicago, and Mateo Mohamed Farzana, who's with Northeastern Illinois University. I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up today on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Bloomington Normal, WNIJ in Rockford DeKalb, WVIK in the Quad Cities, and WSIU in Carbondale. But first, the news from NPR. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. The latest escalation between Iran and Israel began a week ago today. Since June 13th, Israel has struck Iranian nuclear facilities and military targets, while Iran has retaliated with missile attacks on Israeli cities and other sites. Israel said today that 24 people had been killed and another 1,217 are injured. That's according to a report from NBC News this morning. Meanwhile, Al Jazeera reports that Iran has not given regular death toll figures during the attacks. And the last updated reported more than 240 killed, 1,277 others wounded. But Al Jazeera also cited a Washington-based advocacy group that claims the death toll is likely much higher, at least 639 killed. Here in America, President Trump faces a critical decision whether to involve American forces in what could become a much larger regional war. We want to hear from you today. I should say we are, given everything that's happening and the uncertainty over what comes next, we're suspending our usual Friday roundtables to try to understand where this crisis might lead and what it could mean for America. If you want to join us today, the number is 800-222-9455. We'd love to hear how you are thinking about this. How worried are you about the potential of America getting involved in this war? How do you feel about the possibility of Iran joining the list of nations, which includes Israel, that have nuclear weapons? 800-222-9455 is the number. That's 800-222-9455. Joining me now is Nicholas Grossman, political science professor at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, also author of the book Drones and Terror. Also with us, Norma Claire Maruzzi, associate professor at the University of Illinois Chicago, specializing in Iranian studies, and Mateo Mohamed Farzana, professor and chair of both the history and political science departments at Northeastern Illinois University. Welcome to all of you. Thanks for being here. And Nick Grossman, let me start with you, and let's start with the immediate situation. Can you just remind us what happened on June 13th and how it escalated this conflict to where we are today?
So Israel did a surprise attack, a surprise bombing attack on a number of Iranian sites, and then Iran fired back. And that is the immediate situation. The Israeli attack is ongoing. Iran is shooting back at Israel. But to tell the full story, we need to look also at the Middle Eastern wars that have been going on for the last, at this point, about year and a half. That started with the October 7th attack by Hamas on Israel, and then Israel's war in Gaza, and Israel and Hezbollah, which is based in Lebanon, fought a war, that both of those groups are sponsored by Iran. But really, to understand it, we need to go back further to the Iranian nuclear question, which it was 2006 that the International Atomic Energy Agency officially said that Iran was violating the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. Or really, the way they say it, it's diplomatic speak. They say we cannot vouch that they are following it, but that they accuse them of it. And many countries all around the world put sanctions on Iran, and that eventually resulted in the JCPOA, known as the Iran Nuclear Deal, that was in 2015. It's signed by many countries, including Iran. And then in 2018, during Donald Trump's first term, he had the U.S. pull out of it, renege on its side of the deal, and let Iran out of nuclear restrictions in exchange for nothing. And so we have the nuclear question still hanging over us, and that is hanging over a lot of this. But there's also the broader Middle East dynamic and Iran and Israel on opposite sides of a number of fights there.
Yeah, and there's a lot to unpack in that answer, and we will hopefully be able to tease apart a lot of that as we go on. Norma Claire Maruzzi, let me bring you into the conversation now. Talk about how significant are the targets that Israel has hit inside Iran.
Sure, I can do some of that, but I would say that the context of this goes back further, right? And I think especially for Americans trying to figure out what does this all mean, we should be thinking back. Especially to the Iraq wars and what this there's a tendency in the U.S., not just the public, but also the media and government policy to think very short term in terms of Middle East policy, to resort to military strategies without thinking through outcomes. There's been a lot of conversation about where this is going long term and even what the end results are, which is not just, you know, the sort of bellicose posturing that governments do when they're either engaged in warfare or ramping up the energy for it, but really strategically thinking if we go in, whoever the we is, whether that's Israel or the U.S., and by going in doesn't necessarily mean boots on the ground, but means military engagement. How do we get out? What is our end goal, and not just the immediate next week end goal, but farther along. So that's just, I think we need to really think about that, and especially Americans thinking about Americans' involvement should really be worried, right? I mean, the sort of endless war problematic in the region has been predictable in a repeated pattern because of short-term thinking and a kind of overly optimistic, almost first world war model, right? It's going to take a week. That'll be it. We celebrate and get out. And that has not worked out in terms
mission,
of
mission accomplished, right? Mission accomplished.
Yeah, mission. Exactly. Right. That's a forgotten memory. It's not a forgotten memory, but it's a repressed memory precisely because just from the American perspective, lives lost. Right. Cost expended. But also, I think, and this is getting a little off what I wanted to say, but really important to keep in mind, right, even when there's not the immediate obvious cost, destabilization of the region has led to the worst migration crisis in generations. This is already years ago. And that has follow-on effects, right? Destabilization, illegal migration, issues about trade, about security, about insecurity, right? Because of lone actors, small cell groups, which get fragmentation leads to that, right? We've seen that. But in terms of targets, so far, Israel has restrained from really striking hard on the main nuclear sites. This is for a number of reasons. One is they don't have the firepower to destroy them straight out. But also, I think there's real worry about literal fallout. But that means is that they've been targeting military targets, apparently, and infrastructure targets. I mean, they targeted the main television building while a report, and that was on camera. We've seen, many of us have seen the footage of the woman reporter having to flee the room as debris started falling down. She was able to resume broadcast from another room, but. Right. So it isn't just military targets. It's also infrastructure. But much of this infrastructure is located in civilian areas. Right. This is I think people need to think along what would it mean for strategic targets to be bombed in New York City. Right. And the kind of civilian damage. So ordinary apartment buildings are being brought down. There's been quite a bit of loss of life. Ordinary people are scared. They're scared not only about the bombing that's happened so far, but also about the threats. But they don't necessarily know what to do because despite a lot of people have fled Tehran, but not everyone, not everybody knows where to go or has options. And I think there's also a sense that having seen what's happened in Gaza over the last more than a year, if Israel says leave, it's not clear where we'll be safe, right? It's not a clear cut. You can go somewhere else and be relaxed. So it's a mess right now.
Yeah. It's a mess. All right. Let me remind listeners, this is the 21st show. We're talking about the developing situation between Israel and Iran and potentially the United States. This ongoing fighting that's been happening in the last week. If you want to join us today, 800-222-9455. My guests are Nicholas Grossman at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, who talked about the context of the recent wars between Israel and Iran's proxy military organizations and the nuclear deal that came about during the Obama administration. We're speaking with Norma Claire Maruzzi, who reminded us this history also goes back even farther to the Iran, or I should say to the American involvement in Iraq, the invasion of Iraq 2 decades ago. And now I want to bring in Matteo Mohamed Farzana, who is, again, professor and chair of history and political science at Northeastern Illinois University. Do you want to expand the context even further? Because we can go back to the 80s or the 70s or even the 1950s when we're talking about the long history of this conflict.
Sure. I mean, can you hear me?
Can hear you great. Yes, please go ahead.
Okay, I'm sorry. So, yeah, if we want to take it back to the 1950s, obviously we have to mention the overthrowing of the first and only, perhaps, democratically elected government of Mohammad Mossadegh in 1953, which during Operation Ajax, the U.S. Intelligence Service, along with MI6 of the British Intelligence Services, kind of worked together, cooperated to overthrow the government. And due to the fact that the Iranian parliament had voted to essentially kick the British out, the end of the British petroleum as we know it, and they nationalized the oil industry in Iran. That was in 1952. And in 53, the cost of that was that the government of Mossadegh was overthrown by the Americans and the British. And that basically sowed this sense of mistrust and, to an extent, I should say, perhaps hatred against American foreign policy and not necessarily the Americans. Because before that, at the turn of the century, during the Iranian Constitutional Revolution in 1906 and 1911, Americans did work very hard to bring Iran into the fold of the so-called civilized or the democratic governments of the world, especially in the Middle East, knowing the fact that in 1908, oil was discovered in Iran and the importance of it was established from then on as a source of viable energy. So we fast forward from 1953 and the bringing back of the monarchy, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, or the Shah, in 1953, and the establishment of this repressive regime, anti-democratic in many ways, and the creation of the intelligence services of Iran, known as the SAVAK, that repressed political activities of all types and leading to a one-party establishment with the monarchy being the absolute power and basically ignoring a lot of things that the constitutional revolution and the constitution had established in 1906-1911. And that leads to the multi-ideological movement that led and is known as the 1979 revolution or the Islamic revolution, depending on one's perspective. And the animosity that was brought to the fore in a very obvious way under the leadership of the Islamists with Ayatollah Khomeini at the helm, which basically overthrew the monarchy since the Shah left and died in exile in 1980. And only a couple of months later, on September 22nd of 1980, Saddam Hussein and the Ba'ath Party, who had taken over in Iraq, with the green lights that they basically got pretty much from everybody, surprise attacked Iran and entered it into the longest conventional war of the 20th century, the Iran-Iraq War that ended in 1988, leaving casualties of roughly around 256,000 dead, about 800-some-odd thousand people injured and maimed, and tens of thousands as POWs that came back as disabled and what have you. And the sense of patriotism, which was fed by the Islamic identity of those people who volunteered in robes, millions of people who volunteered in robes to help defeat the enemy, and the patriotic Iranians that didn't necessarily get their engines started because of the Islamic identity, but rather their pre-Islamic Persian identity, that really allowed Iran to fight back, although they were getting help from countries such as North Korea, and the black market where they bought most of the weapons from, that basically established this animosity against Iraq and against the West, because everybody and their mother, as they say, helped Iraq to fight Iranians by the use of chemical weapons and what have you, especially Germany, France, and the United States in providing intelligence to the Iraqis where the Iranians couldn't get their hands on. And since it was a withdrawal in 1986, it was a draw, in effect. The Reagan administration decided to make sure that no side is going to win the war, and it basically led to the 1988 UN resolution 598 that created a ceasefire between established a ceasefire between Iraq and Iran. And if we fast forward to the events of 2001, September 11th, and after that, the invasion of Iraq with the United States at the helm, they removed Saddam Hussein, and essentially they handed Iraq to the Iranian government, the theocratic government in Iran. And although Khomeini had died, he was replaced and elected the Council of Expediency, essentially elected Sayyid Ali Khamenei, who is the current supreme leader, who has an absolute power based on Article 27 of the Islamic Revolution Constitution, Islamic Republic Constitution, to veto pretty much all the three branches of the sure. government and what they actually decide.
Yeah. All right. We are coming up on needing to take a break here. Let me remind listeners you can join us today at 800-222-9455. If you are already on the line, please stay with you. We're going to get to some of your calls after this break. Before we do break, I'll share a couple of text messages we got in from listeners about today's topic. Amy in Wakanda says, America has no place getting involved unless we're helping the UN keep citizens safe from the combatants or helping broker peace talks. Stop getting involved. Stop egging on war. Help stop the wars. Help heal the divisions we've caused. Help protect civilians. Christopher in Brimfield says, only a diplomatic solution will solve this problem. We also heard from Tony in Champaign, who said, we need to exhibit more respect for these ancient nations. But if I were Iran, I'd feel duty-bound to pursue the bomb with Israel as a neighbor. Supporting Israel is a huge mistake, he says. 800-222-9455. More to come after a short break. This is The 21st Show. This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We want to hear from you about this developing crisis in the Middle East. What do you think about America potentially intervening in this war between Israel and Iran? How do you feel about the possibility of Iran joining the list of nations, which does include Israel, that already have nuclear weapons? 800-222-9455 is the number to join us today. 800-222-9455. My guests are Nicholas Grossman, professor at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champain, Norma Claire Maruzzi, professor at the University of Illinois Chicago, and Matteo Mohamed Farzana, professor and chair of history and political science at Northeastern Illinois University. Again, to join us, 800-222-9455. And let's go now to the phones. Kamyar is calling from Normal on line one. Kamyar, thank you for calling in.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Go ahead. Do you have a question or a comment about what's happening?
Oh, yeah. So just wanted to add a bit of my perspective. So as you can probably tell by my name, I am Iranian. I was born and raised in California, and I moved to Normal for work. And it's been a very interesting few weeks. As soon as I found out that Israel had bombed Iran a few short minutes after it occurred, and I started getting conversations from friends and family and even coworkers and whatnot regarding what was going on. And for the most part, I was happy that a lot of my friends and acquaintances and whatnot had like a pretty understanding perspective of what's going on. And a lot of them tended to reference like, oh, yeah, this is going to be another Iraq or, you know, like et cetera. But at the same time, I did have conversations with a few people who kind of, despite the fact that There's still the ongoing conflict with the genocide that's happening in Gaza, and you know, just Israel's continued pressure against like other nations and whatnot for, you know, their unwavering support, that people are kind of using the same playbook that they did with Iraq and Afghanistan, and even, you know, with Ukraine and Russia, where they seem to like isolate their thoughts on what's going on and frame it in such a way where it's like, you know, Iran is at fault necessarily for what is happening to them, because of the concept of, oh yeah, they have to be making a nuclear weapon. They have to be the ones that are egging on this conflict. But, you know, you look at history, especially, I'd seen a video recently of all the times that Netanyahu had claimed that Iran was a few days, a month, a year, et cetera, away from having a nuclear weapon. And it's almost like a Curb Your Enthusiasm bit where, you know, they're playing the music where, you know, he's saying this, and it goes all the way back to like 1995 or 92 or however long it was. And it just amazes me that in this age of, you know, the availability of information and news, that like people go on like Fox and NBC and CNN and all these news programs, and they're all like saying, yeah, we should go to war with Iran. We should be bombing them. We should be looking for regime change.
Sure.
And I'm just,
sure.
I just don't get it. It's like, well, are we going to repeat what just happened like less than 20 years ago? Are we going to have another Iraq? Are we going to have another Afghanistan? And you know, we're still going with it now with Ukraine. I just don't understand how people can just keep making, they just keep making the same mistakes. But then, you know, if it's in the best interest of the U.S., I feel like, you know, there's,
sure,
no matter how many questions you ask, it's just going to be right. Like, we're going to do it because we can.
All right, Kamyar, thank you so much for calling in, sharing your perspective. I appreciate that. Nick Grossman, let me come back to you. A couple of different directions we could take that. Maybe I'll leave it to your discretion as to where you want to go.
Sure. On the nuclear question specifically, in comparison to Iraq, that there are a few important distinctions. One in that the with Iraq did not have a weapons of mass destruction program, at least not an active nuclear program, and the U.S. then started the war. Whereas also the last call I mentioned Afghanistan, and that was because al-Qaeda was based there in response to 9/11. With Iran, Iran has a considerably more advanced nuclear program, that they are open about this, or at least about activities such as uranium enrichment and enriching their uranium beyond the levels that would be used for electricity generation, up to the levels that start being able to make an explosion. And this has been a broad consensus among various countries, intelligence agencies, international regulators, that Iran has been in violation of the treaty. That said, the caller is correct that Netanyahu specifically and a number of people who have long advocated regime change in Iran have claimed that Iran is just days away from a nuclear weapon for, at this point, almost 30 years. And the Israeli intelligence claimed that Iran was moving towards it and was very close. But U.S. and other intelligence has disputed that, has claimed that Iran has been enriching uranium, but not constructing a bomb. And if you read between the lines of the Israeli statement, what they're claiming is that Iran was almost having enough material to then be able to construct bombs if they wanted to, not that Iran was about to blow one up tomorrow or use one as a test. And a big part of the reason, therefore, why Israel is likely attacking now is not because that they are convinced that if they don't do it right now, Iran's going to be a nuclear power and will have a deterrent, much as, say, North Korea does, but instead that they have a moment of opportunity, that in particular, Israel significantly weakened Hezbollah, and Hezbollah had been able to fire a lot of rockets into Israel, a lot of them Iranian-supplied rockets, into Israel, and during the Gaza war, when Hezbollah was showing solidarity with Hamas, that they fired and it had depopulated a lot of Israel's north, forced hundreds of thousands of people to leave their homes. So that was a pretty big card that Iran and its allies had against Israel. And that one has been eliminated, has been removed. And so Israel apparently thought that this was their chance to attack Iran. And if they weren't going to do it now, that they might lose the chance. There's also the fact that previous American presidents of both parties had advocated against it. The nuclear negotiations with Iran sanctions and talks about the nuclear deal was the policy of George W. Bush and then Barack Obama, when Israel had floated the idea of attacking not just Hamas and Hezbollah, but attacking Iran over the last year or two. When Joe Biden was president, the U.S. argued against it and was able to, I guess, make that argument convincing. And it is possible that the Israelis think they either have a more sympathetic American president in Donald Trump or one that they are more able to manipulate, that they might have created circumstances that even if the United States does not think that at the moment it's a good idea to join the war, and for reasons such as the Iraq occupation, that Iran has twice the population, about three times the area, any sort of Iraq-style regime change war in Iran would be even harder than that one was, and more costly. From the Israeli perspective, if they manage to collapse the Iranian government, that could draw in the U.S. because then it would create this big power vacuum and potential a lot of chaos where, for example, terrorists might find it attractive to set up. Or if they don't collapse the Iranian government, then they will argue to the United States that the U.S. has to come in and finish the job, that now that things are underway, they can't just let it fester, because if the government survives, if the Iranian government survives, then they have a very strong incentive to go for a nuclear weapon. And if they had nuclear weapons and could threaten a nuclear strike as a deterrent, they, like other nuclear powers, including Israel, would have a very strong card to play against possible invaders or possible attackers. And so while at the moment, it looks like the U.S. administration is not immediately bombing, and where we saw President Trump say that he'd make a decision in 2 weeks, which for anybody who's watched him over the last 10 years is a thing he says when he doesn't really have an answer and is trying to string things along. A famous example of this is he has promised details of his healthcare plan in 2 weeks for about 10 years now and has never produced them. So that is a hint that maybe he and his administration don't want to get directly involved, though there are a lot of people who have been advocating it with him, but don't want to get directly involved, but something could potentially suck the U.S. in anyway. Another example being that if Iran feels really desperate and tries to do something to either attack a U.S. target, like they did in 2020 after Trump had ordered the U.S. to kill an Iranian general, which was in response to rocket fire from some Iran-backed militias in Iraq, and also some of those militias, the Houthis in Yemen are another example of this, could fire on various targets and trying to support. If any of that hits a U.S. target, for example, then the United States could also feel like it has to get involved. So there's both a risk that the United States voluntarily joins the Israeli effort and that it potentially escalates into regime change.
Sure.
So for example, they're also hitting other targets like, say, oil infrastructure, which hints at that. That's more regime change. But it's also possible that the United States could get pulled in, even if that is not really what the government or the people want at this moment.
Yeah. And I mean, the Israeli defense minister openly said he thought that the supreme leader, I don't remember his exact phrasing, but basically called for his, I guess you'd say, assassination or elimination, although Netanyahu did sort of brush him back on that, but said it was still an option. Let's get another caller in, John from Taylorville, line two. John, go ahead.
So I feel the U.S. may have caused this when they pulled out of the nuclear deal in 2017, but regardless of how we got here, we're here now.
John, your phone is breaking up. I'm sorry. I have a little summary from our producers. I think John and Norma Claire Maruzzi, let me put this question to you. I think what the point he was coming to is that wondered if there's an argument that this is an opportunity to head off a, as he says, another North Korea situation in terms of nuclear weapons. What do you think of this whole argument?
I think people should really, I actually applaud the insight of many of the callers. You know, you're getting to the show and my colleagues. But people should stop and think a little bit about what North Korea's example looks like to much of the world. And that's a scary regime. But it's also clear when, because they've got a nuclear weapon, when the U.S. and others have gone after other supposedly rogue states, they've kept hands off North Korea. And the sad thing is that that's an example that sort of shows other vulnerable states that you really, you know, your only real deterrent is to have a nuclear bomb. You know, the North Koreans haven't used it. I mean, I don't want to get into talking too much about North Korea because precisely it's not my area of expertise. But I do think it's one has to sort of think about what that means and why that even for many Iranians who did not support the nuclear effort, the amount of resources and commitment that went into it that could have gone to other more socially productive investments in the country. I'm talking about population, you know, ordinary people in Iran. At this point, there's been much more of a kind of rallying, and that's something we know historically, that the bombing of cities, even among people who are highly critical of their government, tends to elicit nationalism. Even the Iranian government knows this because what they're advertising now is a kind of national solidarity, not an ideological solidarity to the regime, but to Iran. You know, and the symbols that they're publicizing are long running historical, almost mythological symbols about Iranianness, Persianness that go way, way, way back. Right, so that sense of it doesn't matter what your attitude was. You know, this is a time to come together, and ordinary people feel that. That's what bombing of cities does. Again, we know that historically back to the Second World War and beyond. But I think really the thing is, yeah, where are we now? In some ways, all politics is local. And aside from talking about, you know, the Iranian local politics, but we have to think too about, you know, why did Israel and Netanyahu, you know, order this now for some of those strategic reasons? But also, I would say some of it is really local. And Netanyahu has a history of military escalation when he's politically vulnerable, right? So he almost lost a vote, parliamentary vote that could have brought down his government. And next thing, I mean, I just snapped my finger, sorry, but almost next day, he called this because that's almost a guarantee of right solidarity in Israel, where, you know, military engagement leads populations to support their governments no matter what, including opposition, quieting things down. It's quieted down the international outcry about humanitarian losses in Gaza, 70,000 now are the estimates. So, right, starvation, famine, we're getting there. No, and that's not necessarily the first, you know, the first news item anymore. And in the U.S., this is now suddenly scaring people about, so the issues about ICE, about immigration, whatever, that's not necessarily the front page news. I mean, in an unfortunate way, right, it's often very easy to engage in bellicose military adventurism by some governments. Again, that's why I came back to long term. You really want to restrain the Iranian nuclear threat, possibly also the Israeli nuclear threat. That's an open secret nuclear project that is sort of tacitly allowed to proceed, then I would say part of this is negotiation. The Iranians have said they were about to go. They were the many of the government negotiators were about to leave the next day for another stage of negotiation rounds with the U.S. in Oman. This strike was also intended to disrupt negotiated possibilities, right? It's not in Israel's, and I wouldn't even say Israel's, but Netanyahu's personal, right, government interests. I mean, he's open to corruption charges and jail time if he is no longer a government official because he has immunity in his position now. Right, it's not in the Israeli present government's interest for a negotiated settlement between the U.S. and Iran to be successful. And I think Trump hasn't really figured out which way he wants to go, and he does have a kind of tendency to do very short-term statements. The question is, where will this get the U.S., right? Short-term, medium-term, long-term. Doesn't seem really great. Military, let me put that, military options don't seem in the long-term self-interest, even of Israel, yeah, let alone Iran and the region. And one last thing I should add here.
Sure,
is,
we're coming up on a break, so go ahead quickly. Yes.
Yeah, quickly. Speaking with colleagues this morning, Egyptian public opinion is now supporting Iran. They don't trust Iranians, right?
Interesting.
But they're really worried about effects in the region. So this is, you know, this is a bigger question than even just these three actors.
All right, we're going to continue this conversation after the break. If our guests can stay with us a little longer than we had originally planned, 800-222-9455 to join us today here on the 21st Show. We're talking about Iran, Israel, the possibility of U.S. involvement in that war. More to come after a break. This is the 21st Show. This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking about the war between Israel and Iran and the possibility of U.S. involvement in that. We heard President Trump just yesterday through a spokeswoman saying that he's going to take 2 weeks to ponder that possibility. But there are a lot of voices on different sides. Interesting political coalitions developing in America about this, too. Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Congressman Tom Massie, who do not see eye to eye on much policy-wise, but are both opposed to American involvement here. What do you think? 800-222-9455 is the number to join us today. We are speaking with Norma Claire Maruzzi, who is a professor at the University of Illinois, Chicago, associate editor of the journal Iranian Studies. Nick Grossman is a political science professor at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, also a senior editor at ARC Digital and author of the book Drones and Terror. And Mateo Mohamed Farzana is professor and chair of history and political science at Northeastern Illinois University. And Professor Farzana, let me bring you back into the conversation now. There was a lot said before the break. I don't know if you want to respond to any of the callers or anything that was said there, or we can move on to other aspects of this situation.
Sure. I think there is one point that needs to be made very clear for the listeners that has to do with how American foreign policy is basically unleashed in the Middle East by its only client, which is the State of Israel. Israel does not have a foreign policy. Israel only has a domestic policy, which means this is, according to Henry Kissinger, not one of my most favorite politicians, but I think it says a lot. Israel cannot, has not, and does not do anything without a green light from the United States. However, Washington wants to play it out that we didn't know or we weren't aware or Israel was vague about this. Because if you remember, once this happened on June 13th, last week, last Friday, there were sort of different messages coming out of Washington saying we didn't know, they didn't check, but later on they said no, it was coordinated. So in some ways, I like people to start maybe thinking as a different perspective that Israel foreign policy really is American foreign policy. Whether or not the United States does not want to make a deal with Iran, which I'm not sure if that's the case right now, or whether or not the State of Israel has enough push in Washington to want Washington to go the other way around, because Israel did its best during the Obama administration to get Americans out of the JCPOA agreement or the nuclear agreement. Regardless of that, I think it's very, very important to mention that Israel is the biggest client. The American taxpayers pay over $2.5 billion, if not $3 billion a year in aid, perhaps the highest number, and second to that is the Republic of Egypt. So we meaning the United States, Washington, State Department, kind of dictates what they have to do. And I think that's something that gets missed out a lot, because Americans tend to want to blame others for being dragged into things. I don't think Americans are dragged into things. Americans do it, but they have made a perception or illusion that they're not.
Interesting. How do you rate the threat of Iran, the government there gaining access to nuclear weapons, as opposed to, you know, India, Pakistan, North Korea, Israel, all the many other countries that are the more recent members of the nuclear nations?
Up until last Friday, there was an effective fatwa or a religious decree issued by Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader, the absolute power in Iran, that Iran cannot and should not go after weapons of mass destruction in any shape or form. That was clearly stated. It's part of the foreign policy that comes out of his office. Now, we are hearing various news that he has relinquished certain powers, which includes also the possibility that the Iranian nuclear agency can pursue a nuclear weapon in light of what has been happening since last week. Now, I'm not privy to any information inside Iran or anything like that, but I think it would make sense for them to want to do it. But whether or not they would actually do that, because they would know that would be the end of it for them. Remember, what they gained during the Iran-Iraq war was this highly sophisticated defense technology that now we see the results of because of the Iran-Iraq war that was developed in Iran. And if they want to create a nuclear weapons program, they probably could, but I think there are way too many eyes watching over them and they can't do it. But listen, North Korea did it, and that's why it's a great deterrent for them. But look where the nation of Korea, North Korea is. Libya had a nuclear program and they gave it up voluntarily. Look what happened to the person who gave it up. That's Colonel Gaddafi. Israel also attacked the Osiris nuclear facilities in Iraq in 1981 in the middle of the Iran-Iraq war, simply because they thought that Iraq was getting close to it. So this idea of non-proliferation, I think it's a great ideal. But if you have a state that has a proven record of killing innocent people and being an occupying power according to international law and according to UN Security Council resolutions back in the 1960s, that they are a occupying power in West Bank and in Gaza and in the Golan Heights, then I wouldn't be surprised that this non-proliferation idea will last long. Listen, Saudi Arabia's got a ton of money, ton of sources. They can effectively buy this technology from somewhere. I would not be surprised if one day they come and say, you know, we're going to do something with it. And if they do it secretly, as they did the Pakistanis, I wouldn't be surprised. So what's the solution for all of this? I think the United States has to get its nose out of regional politics in order to solve all of these problems. It would be interesting for people to start thinking all of this stems from the fact that the United States unequivocally has been supporting the state of Israel since its foundation in May of 1948. It hasn't been an honest broker. It's been the most dishonest broker, because when they come very, very close to making a deal, U.S. does something to thwart all their efforts. So I think that's something for people to kind of think about as well.
Nick Grossman, what do you think of that in terms of the, you know, whether Iranian government gaining access to nuclear weapons? How do you rate that threat?
First thing, I just feel I have to push back on the claim that Israel has no foreign policy, the Israeli government has no agency, they just do whatever America tells them to. That's not true. That clearly the United States has been a big supporter of Israel, and they work together on a bunch of things. But we even saw just last year of different things that, for example, the Biden administration tried to get Israel to stop doing, for example, to heavily bomb Rafah in Gaza, and that didn't work. And there have been other examples. So color me very skeptical that the Israelis were just acting out American foreign policy by bombing Iran, as opposed to acting out Israeli foreign policy, or as previously mentioned, a factor of Israeli domestic politics as well. That said, that the nuclear question has been considered very widely to be a big threat, and that Iran, whatever official religious ruling the supreme leader might have said, was in fact going for it. And this was a consensus of U.S., Britain, France, Germany, Russia, China, Europe, and the United Nations International Atomic Energy Agency. And they even showed some slides of different bomb designs that the Iranians had worked on at this point quite a few years ago. But the Israelis in particular really like to, I'd say, exaggerate or either miscast what the threat of an Iranian nuclear weapon is, that they cast the Iranians as effectively suicidal, that Iran would, as soon as they get one, either give one to terrorists or launch one at Israel. And the Iranians know that that would result in Israeli nuclear retaliation. And like every leader of every country, the Iranian leaders like Iran existing. And they have never shown anything since they took over the country in 1979, have never shown a foreign policy that is irrational and suicidal. But the reason why so much of the world, including the United States, considers it to be a potential threat is the broader cause of nonproliferation, in that it is extremely difficult, if not impossible, to get somebody who already has the bomb to give it up. But there are a number of ways to try to prevent or discourage somebody who doesn't have it yet from getting it. And the reason why is just more means more danger. With Iran specifically, there are questions of who would control it, of whether there would be any rogue actors who could potentially steal it, of whether they would maybe, even though I think this is unlikely, give it to a group such as Hezbollah, who might be more willing to use it. That what the Israelis are really afraid of is not that Iran is going to commit suicide with an aggressive nuclear attack, but that it will achieve a deterrent. It will achieve nuclear parity. And so that if the United States is in another confrontation with Iran at some point, if Israel is in a confrontation again with, say, Hezbollah, that then Iran would be able to say, Israel, don't bomb Lebanon because we are backing them with nuclear weapons. If you do so, we're going to use a nuclear strike against you, which is similar to how the United States protects countries such as, say, allies Japan, South Korea. These are under what's called America's nuclear umbrella. And so from the international security perspective, there's a big fear also that if Iran did get a bomb, it could set off a nuclear cascade with the Saudis, as mentioned, Turkey, Egypt, others. And that just further multiplies the possibilities of accidents, miscalculations, theft, and all the other potentially disastrous problems. So there's been a really wide consensus about it. The problem, though, is that there is not a clear military solution. At minimum, there is no military solution that doesn't involve the United States. So the Israelis know that they are not able to destroy a facility that the Iranians built called Fordo, and it is built deep into a mountain, in part because the Iranians saw that Israel destroyed a reactor in Iraq in 1981, Israel destroyed a reactor in Syria under construction in 2007, and the Iranian program is a lot more advanced, more dispersed, more hardened. It is essentially smarter and better able to withstand attack. So the only way that the Israelis could actually get the facility at Fordo destroyed would be with United States getting involved and using U.S. weaponry. And even then, it creates all the problems of then, well, what next? And nobody really seems to have a plan for that. The solution that was successful, the diplomatic solution that was successful, was the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal reached in 2015.
Sure.
And once the United States reneged on that without cause, it made any future negotiations extremely difficult, because why would Iran trust the U.S.? That they made a deal, they were following it. All the other parties to the deal, including the Europeans, the Russians, the Chinese, all said that Iran was following it, and the U.S. just reneged on it. So Iran knows that even if perhaps they trusted a different U.S. president, the Biden administration also tried to get another deal and it didn't work, because not only would Iran not be trustful of the United States, they would know that the U.S. is at most one election away from having a leader that might just renege on U.S. commitments and make it that the various things that Iran traded off was not worth it. And so we have been on this path for a while without there being a good solution. And something like the U.S. just leaving the Middle East and not being involved is something that would extract America, perhaps, but is very unlikely to make the place into a stable, peaceful region, because of all these other things have been put in play for years. All the local animosities and fights, and also a lot of the ones that the United States and other foreign powers have either caused or contributed to, including the coup in Iran in the 50s or the Iraq War in the 2000s.
Yeah. All right. We are so short on time. And I guess just a few sentences, Norma Claire Maruza, we haven't heard from you in a while. What do you want listeners to be thinking about as they're pondering where America's role is in this in the future?
So thanks, and thanks for all the conversation. I would say to listeners, a really fast thing is contact your elected representatives and advocate no war with Iran negotiations. There's a broad movement across multiple political positions that this is not a good thing to just jump into, sort of eyes closed, both feet. Contact your representatives and keep in mind that the Iranian regime, whatever you think of it, and I've been very critical over years, but they are savvy about survival. And there are other ways besides direct military to disrupt things. There was just a big GPS disruption this last week of tankers in the Gulf of Hormuz, right? So economic disruption as well, like this. Contact your representatives, say no war, advocate for negotiation. That will give some time to figure things out at the least. Thanks, and thanks so much.
Norma Claire Maruzzi is at the University of Illinois Chicago, Matteo Muhammad Farzana at Northeastern Illinois University, Nick Grossman, the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. A very robust conversation, a lot more to discuss. This will not be our last conversation on this topic here on the 21st Show. If you have more questions for us, do keep in touch. Talk@21stshow.org is the address. Talk@21stshow.org. You can also find that at our website, 21stshow.org. That is it for us today. The 21st Show is produced by Christine Hatfield, Harrison Malkin, and Jose Zepeda. Leila Nerozova is an associate producer, and our digital producer is Kulsum Khan. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick's our news director. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thank you for listening. We'll talk with you again on Monday.